Lowe's early Black Friday deals are going fast. Don't miss up to 50% off select major appliances. Plus, up to an extra 25% off when you bundle select major appliances. And with Christmas around the corner, you're going to need more string lights, right? Save $4 on GE LED 100-count string lights, now just $5.98. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 12/3. Selection varies by location. Select locations only while supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
This is one of those cases that really makes you do a double take. You hear the words come out of someone's mouth. Former adult film star decapitated the father of her children and married his son. And you think, there's no way that's real. Or do you? Or do you, in 2025, are you kind of like me going, well, anything's possible? That's this story. That's the story of this woman. Maybe you've seen her in some court coverage that's going on right now. We're going to dive into this one because it's, yeah. Because why not? You know? It's real. It's happening in Nevada in a courtroom right now. It's not tabloid fiction. It's not a Netflix script, although maybe it will be at some point. It's a murder trial with a real body, real families, and a story so warped it is hard to process. Give me your thoughts on this in the comment section on YouTube as I go through it, guys, because I'd love to hear it. Her name is Devin Michaels. That's the name the public knows, though she worked under other names back when she was in the adult entertainment industry. She's not a celebrity per se anymore, but the residue of that world, the image, the chaos, the constant self-reinvention hangs over her like static. And now she's sitting at a defense table accused of one of the most grotesque killings Nevada has seen in quite some time. The man she's accused of taking the life of was named Jonathan Willett, the father of her two daughters. In August of 2023, his mother walked into his home. Let's go through this again. In August of 2023, his mother walked into his home in Henderson and found her son dead. His body was lying face down on the bedroom floor, soaked in chemicals. He was gone. I mean, imagine that moment for a second. You walk into your child's home and there's no scene of life left, just the smell of bleach, the shimmer of something that used to be human. People described it as one of the most disturbing crime scenes they'd ever entered. There was evidence of an attempted cleanup, ammonia, bleach, streaks where someone had tried to wipe the walls. It wasn't just a killing, it was an obliteration. Whoever did this wanted him erased physically, forensically, symbolically. The first person police went looking for was the woman who knew him best and arguably the one who had the most to lose, Devin. She wasn't just an ex, she was also the stepmother, technically, the wife of Jonathan's adult son. Yeah, Devere. The triangle was complete. Devin had once been with the father, then legally married the son. The same two little girls who called Jonathan their dad were now living in a home where their stepfather was also their half-brother. Yeah. Healthy choices from healthy people. There's no polite way to describe how twisted all of this is, but it's the foundation of the entire case. By 2021, Devin and Jonathan were long over. She had moved in with Devere. They were public about their marriage, posting online, trying to normalize something that was never going to be normal. People around them described them as dynamic as toxic, confusing, unstable. The family splintered. Jonathan, for all his flaws, was reportedly furious. He wanted to see his daughters more. He wanted to reestablish some kind of order. And that's when the friction started to feel dangerous. Prosecutors say Devin saw him as a threat. He wasn't just an ex, he was someone who could dismantle everything she'd built. She found a way to stay at the center of both men's lives and stay relevant, powerful, connected. If Jonathan moved back in or pushed for custody, that balance could collapse. So prosecutors say she decided to remove him from the equation completely. You know, like good decision makers do. August 6th of 23, a Sunday night that became a crime scene before sunrise. The evidence shows Devin's Nissan Armada leaving her driveway around 2 a.m. GPS data from her vehicle and her phone both pinged near Jonathan's home within minutes of each other. There's no forced entry, no sign of a struggle in the driveway, but sometime between 2:04 and 2:44 a.m., something happened inside that house that ended with a man's headless body on the floor. The coroner later determined that the decapitation occurred after death. I mean, someone first took his life, possibly blunt force trauma, and then for chits and giggles, removed his head afterward. The effort it took, the time, the strength, it wasn't quick. It wasn't impulsive. It was deliberate. This is not Mortal Kombat. It does take some work to do something like that. And quite a stomach, too. I mean, I can't... Now, I'm not a good one to speak on anything like this, because back when there was, like, the Surgery Channel and you flip through stuff, just that 2 seconds where you're, like, trying to flip through channels was enough for me. Couldn't do something like this. It takes a special individual. One who maybe, you know, could have gone into the medical field or something, because it's a good thing. There's people that can stomach that. But this one went into the adult entertainment industry and the poor choice lifestyle. When police searched Devin's home later that day, they found Jonathan's wallet and identification sealed in a bag in her garage. To detectives, it looked like staging. Like she was trying to hide things that tied her to him. She denied everything. She said she hadn't been near his home. She said she didn't even know he was dead. When investigators confronted her with GPS data showing otherwise, she changed her story, claimed she'd gone there because she was worried about him, that he'd been depressed. The timeline didn't match, the story didn't hold, and by the time the arrest warrant was signed, investigators had a digital trail. Her phone, her car, the surveillance camera down the block, and the neighbor who reported hearing a vehicle idling in the middle of the night. It wasn't enough to prove murder beyond a reasonable doubt yet, but it was enough to paint a picture. And the picture was dark. The prosecution says this wasn't a crime of passion, it was control. They argue that Devin Michaels had built her life on being the center of gravity in every relationship she touched. When Jonathan tried to pull away or reclaim control, she reacted the only way she knew how, through dominance. It's the same pattern that defined her career, her relationships, her home, her image over reality. Control over chaos. The defense paints a different portrayal entirely. They say Devin was broken, not brutal, that she was in an abusive cycle with both men, and that her husband, Jonathan's son, had far more reason to want his father dead. Devere had grown up watching his dad's volatility, and the relationship between the two men was strained long before Devin ever entered the picture, they say. The defense argues that the violence of the crime, the strength, the decapitation, the cleanup points to someone else. They also point to a crucial fact. There's no DNA evidence linking Devin to the murder. No murder weapon, no head even, just circumstantial evidence. Strong, but circumstantial. Still, there's something undeniably sinister about the sequence of events. After Jonathan's death, Devin didn't behave like someone grieving. She continued life with her husband, continued caring for the daughters, even reached out to people asking if they'd seen Jonathan, as though they were trying to play innocent before anyone connected the dots. When police finally arrested her, she didn't show emotion, no tears, no shock, just an eerie calm. Later, she pled guilty, only to withdraw that plea months later, claiming she'd been coerced, that her lawyers pressured her, and that she was innocent. That reveal is one of the reasons the case feels so unstable. It raises questions about her state of mind, about whether she's a master manipulator or a deeply damaged person who's learned how to perform contrition when it serves her. The reality? Both. Both can coexist simultaneously. And that's probably what's driving this. The prosecution's version is almost Shakespearean in its cruelty. A woman so determined to maintain her power that she killed her father of her the father of her children to protect her marriage to his son. The defense insists that version is a fantasy, that Devin is just the easiest person to hate in a house full of dysfunction. Either way, the facts remain brutal. A father was found beheaded. His children lost both parents in the same night, one to murder, one to accusation. And the missing head even now hangs over the trial like a ghost that refuses to rest. It's worth stopping for a second to think about what that means in a case like this. Decapitation isn't just an act of violence. It is an act of erasure. It's about control. It's about dominance, even after death. Whoever did this didn't just want Jonathan gone. They wanted to strip him of identity. No face, no expression, no humanity left to look back at them. It's as if the killer wanted to make sure he could never look at them again. That's what gives this story its nightmare quality, because the physical act of murder can be impulsive, but this took time, effort, intent, the kind of dark, cold patience that only comes from obsession. Now in court, every movement is dissected, every data point, every digital ping, every emotional twitch. The prosecution shows the GPS map of her SUV creeping down that residential street at 2 a.m. They play footage from a neighbor's camera that shows a vehicle matching hers leaving the scene. They show the jury the bags found in her garage, the cleaning chemicals, the inconsistencies in her stories. Gee, I wonder what happened. The defense counters with photographs, with testimony about her size, her physical limitations, her character, her fear. They remind jurors that Devin's husband had access to the same vehicle, the same tools, and the same motive. The courtroom becomes a psychological battlefield. Because at its heart, this isn't just about who swung the weapon. It's about how a family could decay into something this unrecognizable. It's about what happens when power replaces love and when control becomes the only thing that feels like safety. If you strip away the headlines, the adult film star, the beheading, and the love triangle, what you're left with is something even more disturbing. Three people trapped in a feedback loop of resentment and need. A father who wanted control, a son who wanted approval, and a woman who wanted to be the center of both. It's the kind of emotional architecture that can't hold its own weight forever. Eventually, something collapses. And when it did, the collapse wasn't just emotional. It was literal, physical, violent. Now jurors are left to make sense of the wreckage. They're being asked to decide whether Devin Michaels is a manipulative killer who used sex and control as weapons, or whether she's a scapegoat for a family tragedy that's been decades in the making. Either way, the story ends in the same place with a man dead, his body desecrated, his family destroyed, and a woman staring at the possibility of spending the rest of her life in a prison cell. The head has never been found. The weapon has never been found. And maybe that's what makes the story so haunting, because even with all the data, all the technology, all the evidence, we're still left staring into that empty space where something vital should be. Like the missing head, the truth in the case feels gone, burned, buried, dissolved in bleach. What's left is only what each side wants you to see. And that's the tragedy of it. The facts are horrifying enough, but the real horror, the one that sticks with you, is the realization that this family didn't just fall apart in one night in Henderson. It was falling apart for years. The murder was just the final symptom of something much deeper, much sicker. And as the jury watches those images, the car, the timestamps, the evidence bags, they're not just judging a crime. They're looking at the ruins of a family that once called itself love. Because at the center of this story, what you really find isn't lust or jealousy or even rage, it's decay. The slow, silent rot of people who mistook possession for affection and control for connection. That's the real horror here. The head's missing, yes, but so is everything that once made them human. Give me your thoughts in the comments section. This is a... Is it more common than you think? I don't know. I hope not. I hope not. Is there a lot of this going on where it's the... Let's marry the son of the person you were formerly with, and then the kids are technically... Yep. Good decision makers. Good decision makers. Your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube. Search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi and leave them there. This should be an interesting one.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime.